Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Help TVO create a better world through the power of learning. Visit TVO.org and make a tax-deductible donation today.
You were one of the participants for this pilot project. Can you remind us why you decided to sign up for the Basic Income Pilot Project?
Well, with signing up to the Basic Income Pilot, they were looking to gather some data and to be able to measure if this program would possibly work. So it was a study for our mental health, healthy foods, just work if that applied to folks. So it was getting involved in gathering data. And out of that, my hope was to help change and the stigma and show a need for basic income.
Bonnie, you worked closely with people who signed up for the pilot project. Is it a similar story that Dana had sort of just told right now as to why people in Thunder Bay were signing up for the program?
Definitely. And of course, one of the other reasons was people were hopeful to be lifted out of poverty. They were hopeful that a decent income over the next 3 years, which is how long the pilot project was supposed to last, would be enough income and enough time for them to go back to school, get an education, a degree or a diploma, start a small business. So there were dreams and there were hopes. And that's what I heard mostly from participants that entered the project from Thunder Bay.
I do want to ask you, Bonnie, you know, you were on the ground signing people up. Reportedly, there was some skepticism about the program when it first started. Was it challenging to find people to sign up initially?
Not at all. Actually, at the Lakehead Social Planning Council, where I work, we have a community volunteer income tax program that does where volunteers complete taxes for income taxes for people that earn a low income. And many of those people wanted to hop on. Now, of course, some of them who were receiving possibly ODSP, the Disability Support Program income in Ontario, were fearful that some of their expenses might not be covered if they were flying to Toronto every 2 weeks for treatments or whatever the case may be. There were some people that decided not to join, but the greater percentage of people did join, and they weren't skeptical when they joined. They were hopeful.
Dana, I actually saw you nodding your head when I was asking that question. Curious, was there a little bit of skepticism in the beginning, or was it that sort of description that Bonnie had given?
For myself, I found a lot of it was anybody that was on ODSP. I myself, a recipient of ODSP when the pilot was launched. So a lot of people thought that they would be punished or lose their ODSP. So it was definitely reassuring people that there was with informed consent. It's like, this is going to happen for you. You're not going to lose your ODSP if you decide to sign on. You will not have it removed from you when the program is over. So it was definitely going around my community and confirming with people, this is not what's going to happen because of myself, and let them know my steps with being an ODSP recipient. And the information was shared lots.
Jamil, get us started. How would you characterize the security threat that you believe, or don't, TikTok represents?
Well, I think that TikTok does represent a security threat in a particular sense. I think all social media platforms do. Social media platforms collect a huge amount of information about their users, and that's certainly true of TikTok. TikTok maybe raises additional concerns because of its connection to the Chinese government, or its possible connection to the Chinese government. I think the real question is not whether TikTok presents a threat, but rather what the best way is of addressing it.
Which we shall do. Taylor, how would you answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends how we define a risk and a national security threat. I mean, there's certainly a capacity on these platforms to shape discourse and influence discourse, as we've seen in elections, previous elections on other platforms. There's clear potential abuses of data, as Jamil mentioned. There's a whole host of broader sort of health, public health issues that we could bring into our national security conversation, although I would sort of warn not to. But there's also economic interest here. And the U.S. government, whose bill or legislation we're talking about, has a long history of incorporating economic power and interests into their national security threat assessments, which is clearly happening here, too.
Janice, do you see a genuine national security threat to Canada here?
I agree with Taylor. Of course, there's a security threat. Anytime you agglomerate and collect data in the way that all social media platforms do, the fact that it's owned by China, and there is no separation, adds an extra dimension. But on the spectrum of national security threats from China, this is at the very low end of the spectrum. And that's, I think, the bigger story. There are many more serious ones.
Connor.
I think those who study China understand that the distinction between a corporation and the government's interests is a legal fiction. In other words, it exists on paper, but not in fact. And what that means is that TikTok, its owner ByteDance, is controlled by a group of data kleptomaniacs. And they should not be within a mile of controlling such a platform. The worst thing that American social media companies, and they absolutely should be reined in, the worst thing they're going to do really is try to sell you something. With TikTok, the threats are far greater.
Let's follow up on the data angle. We are told that a quarter of Canadians use TikTok. So Taylor, follow up on that. What sort of data can be mined given that reality?
Well, it's the same kind of data that can be mined by a large social platform that acts as an intermediary between our devices, mostly our phone, and our commercial and daily social activity on the internet. So it's the things we purchase, where we go, our faces in terms of facial recognition technologies that are embedded in these tools, our political beliefs, our political engagement and activity. I mean, it is a lot about us, which is why many people have been arguing for clamping down on some of those data collection capacities from a broad range of platforms. The question here is, I think what Connor mentioned, like, is there something different about this company collecting these data? I think that's at the core of some of these issues.
How much confidence do you have in the current Competition Bureau's ability to reduce this phenomenon of greenwashing?
Well, it's an interesting period of time. We've had a couple of cases that have gone after a relatively narrow definition of greenwashing, but now we're seeing complaints, I'm sure we'll discuss more, that look at a broader definition, more about claims of overall business models or a brand entirely. So it's really uncharted waters, I think. There have been some successes in the past, but they've been fairly narrowly defined. So I'm interested to see how these broader claims do under our current law.
We will dive into all of this. Julien, how about you? How much confidence do you have in the Competition Bureau's ability to do something about this?
I think it's their job. It's clearly in their mandate. Of course, they have limited resources. So the Competition Bureau does a lot of things. They do mergers. They investigate cartels, so all sorts of deceptive practices. They're really a watchdog that has a lot to do. But if it's not them, then who is it going to be? They're the only federal agency that can address greenwashing at the national level. They have experts. They have professional investigators, so we expect that they need to do it, because if they don't do it, then who else?
If not them, then who? Tanya, what do you think in terms of their ability to do this? Julie makes it sound like they got a lot on their plate already.
They do have a lot on their plate, but deceptive marketing is really important for, you know, protecting consumers, making sure we have a fair playing field. And I think that if the federal government can really help the Competition Bureau out by, you know, setting some laws and rules that they could then enforce, because that's what they do. And I think that they will do a great job of that.
Let me mix it up a bit with you here, Phil, which is, what do you think prompts companies to greenwash in the first place?
It's a great question. I mean, I think companies are starting to realize that sustainability is table stakes. A lot of people thought that it was going to be a passing fad. And if anything, since the pandemic, making sure that your business is sustainable has only increased in importance. And there is certainly a desire for some companies to show that they're doing something and a temptation to take a shortcut, which is what greenwashing is. Becoming sustainable is very hard. It's costly and it takes real work. And some folks want to reap the benefit without putting the work in.
But Tanya, presumably you do it because you think you will get away with it. Right? Is that why they do it?
That could be a reason you could get away with it. Another reason could be that there's not enough rules and guidance, and maybe some companies just need a little bit more help. And that's where the Competition Bureau could step up. They could issue some greenwashing guidance that really sets some examples. We see that in other jurisdictions.
Julian, is that right? I shouldn't necessarily be so nefarious in my interpretation here. Maybe they just don't know the rules well enough. Is that possible?
That's possible. That's certainly possible. A lot of them have good intents. They want to do good. They want to tap in these new green markets. They want to attract consumers that are interested in sustainable products, whatever that means. So yes, a lot of them want to do it well. And Tanya raises a very good point. There needs to be guidance out there. We heard a lot of companies I've been doing some research on this topic for some time. And many times I heard companies saying, we want to do it well. We're interested in making genuine environmental claims. But what does green mean? If I want to say that I want to supply a green product, what does that mean? What's the bar? Which standards do I need to comply with? And that's really the challenge here. It's that there is legal uncertainty. The Bureau needs to step in and provide guidance. But of course, guidance is not everything. There also needs to be some very concrete laws that can address this phenomenon.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is made possible through generous philanthropic contributions from viewers like you. Thank you for supporting TVO's journalism.